go from Russia to USA, and he could not speak English. And he asked, he was advised that English is just the same as Russian, but you should speak very, very slowly. And in taxi, he met a guy, the driver, who asked him with this Russian slowly English, where are you going to go? And he said, I'm going to New York. And so they spoke this way. In one moment, the driver asked, where are you from? I am from Russia. Me too. So why we speak English? Okay, so I will try to speak slowly. So everybody is fine. Okay, so I will speak about some problem in interpretation of data. Actually, I was born as a theoretician, but some time I spent trying to be between theoretician and experimentalist, because sometimes when we hear some very beautiful description how constant could affect nucleosynthesis or various models, somebody should explain experimentally that this is just the models, and in other models the results could be completely different, etc., etc., etc. So that's what I do in the business of new physics. And today I'm going to speak about some problem in interpretation of data if somebody like to look for new physics from conventional experiments. And we observed in the recent year just a fantastic progress in quantum optics and atomic physics. It's possible to manipulate single atoms, do very precision measurements, et cetera, et cetera. And it was 3 Nobel Prizes in last year. Perhaps that is, and what is the most amazing is not that it was so many prizes in quantum optics, but these prizes were the relatively recent results. So perhaps the last prize, which was for frequency comp, two experimentalists received for frequency comp, and theoretician received for some older work, and frequency comp was developed perhaps last 10 years, even less. So it's quite good results. And at the same time, we see a terrible shortage of data on new physics. So when I was graduated from university, they taught us that just perhaps tomorrow the Higgs particle will be discovered. And since then, I spent in physics over 20 years, 25 years, and still there's no Higgs particle. So we have shortage of data, not only on extension of the standard model, but even on the standard model. We don't know whether we should have a point like Higgs particle in reality or not. And we also know that in short distances, it should be some quantum gravity, and still we have no ideas what we can learn experimentally about quantum gravity. So that's the problem. We have no data. And how we can measure?
The answer is very simple. Either, you know, the nature is so kind to us to give some, you know, bizarre effects as the violation of Lorentz invariance or something like that coming from quantum gravity, or nothing. You will measure nothing from that.
Sure. But still we have no ideas, like if you measure that with such an accuracy, you definitely will get an answer. We don't have such any suggestion for any realistic experiment about quantum gravity. What could be really measured in 10 years, and what should be do a crucial answer. So, but if we try, but since the most accurate experiments are in quantum optics and atomic physics, why not to try to apply that for various new issues like variation of constants, physics at the Planck scale, searching for CPT invariants, violation of CPT invariants, violation of fuzzy symmetries. And so I will try to give a little bit general discussion, some examples about interpretation. So there are, in principle, two kinds of experiments. One kind pretend to be model independent, and sometimes, very seldom, could be. And the other are obviously model dependent, but actually almost all of them are not free of various conceptual problem and some arbitrary hidden suggestions and misinterpretation. So one very, if you like to look for variation of constants, you can think that let's measure some constant in different time. And if you speak about local time invariance, which is part of relativistic symmetries, you believe that result of measurements should not depend on when you do the measurement. but it's believed that sometimes that local time invariance is equivalent of non-variation of constant. It's not so, because when we speak about Lorentz invariance, we basically suggest that we deal with free particles, do kind of fundamental experiment, free particle, free space, no environment, etc. But actually, we are not free of environment, and this some, for instance, simple example, when we measure gravity at the Earth, acceleration of free fall, we can see that the effects of moon and sun, they are a few orders of magnitude higher than uncertainty of the measurement. So that means that in some laboratory scale measurement, sun and moon are part of environment. So it's not so easy to exclude it. And with modern precision, there's a lot of things outside of laboratory which is a kind of environment. Some matter distribution, dark matter, bus of cosmic microwave background, not only of photons, but also of neutrons and gravitons. So in principle, we have a lot of items which could affect the measurement, and we would say that it's not a test of Lorentz invariance if it is driven by environment. For instance, if we remember inflation model, in a sense, the masses of electrons, a little bit of protons, alpha, were affected by environment, but it was no breakdown of local time invariance. And if we find eventually that we have a model like, you know, Dilaton model or scalar field or whatever, it would be variation of constant, but we should not say that it's violation of Lorentz invariance in general. So one of problems with PowerPoint transparency is that if you take talk prepared some time ago, it's very hard to check what should be the next transparency. Yeah, but when you update, you change few transparencies, but you still have no time to learn something in between. So one example of model-dependent interpretation is electric dipole moment. So modern theory allow no dipole moment until you violate some basic symmetries like CP, which is in fact violated. And standard theory produce a very small value which is below detectable level. And if you, we consider some extension, we can we some, I don't know what is, it's low some range of, let's say, 5 orders of magnitude, part of which were already studied. And so there are some interpretation of these experiments on so-called search of electric dipole moment. However, the actual interpretation of the experiments is model dependent. And what is wrong here is that the results are could be produced only by some CP violations. This is another option. If we assume that there is a kind of violation of Lorentz invariance, doesn't matter whether in fundamental level or because of any specific field which somehow select a preferred frame. In this case, we have additional vector, which is velocity in respect to this frame. And in principle, we can either have dipole moment as directed along this velocity v, or directed along this product, which is v and c, so it's a vector. So we actually, for a particle with spin, we have two more vectors. And so all experiments had in mind that it could be directed only along the spin. But still, this quantity is electric dipole moment. If it is
time symmetry,
aren't they? Yeah, we somehow violate Lorentz symmetries and have a vector. And if we have a vector, that means that we have other directions. And that means that it should be different kind of experiments to check whether we have electric dipole moment directed along the spin, electric dipole moment directed along the velocity, and electric dipole moment directed along this product. And once we go...
That violates other things. That also, also violates, you know, quantum statistics.
Sure, but I don't know how quantum statistics is related to electric dipole moment.
Well, you would have, you know, different periodic tables.
The thing is that EDMs, you know, you use the external electric field, right? And in some sense, you lose it because it's small in the scale of particle physics. If you have violation of Lorentz invariance, you should look for the effect that do not depend on your laboratory fields, that have Yes, because you will have
much better. But you can have also this coupling.
Because this coupling that you write usually leads to the Lorentz violation effects without any external fields, and that will provide much better.
The question is that maybe you could first constrain these terms from another experiment. That's another story. What I like to say is that the straightforward interpretation of most of experiments in search of electric dipole moment constrain only one of three options, which assume Lorentz invariance. Whether we can constrain other two options from other experiments, it's another story. So just in this experiment, they just do not concede to other options at all.
And so, otherwise, the paper would be five times as long.
But you know, you should, you know, if you don't like to consider real physics because the paper is too long, and like to consider only part of it, it's not a way how we do science.
Let me put this in a slightly more objective way: is that non-zero EDM that you can measure is physics beyond the standard model, some way unexpected.
Okay, let's separate. You can check model or you can measure EDM. It's not the same. If you try to set a certain parameter, a certain constraint on parameter of extension of standard model, you cannot care about these two terms. And you can say that a special parameter, now epsilon double prime, is below a certain value. That's one story. But if you say that after you measure EDM is below something, you should consider all possible options. And I don't see why one option is more important than the other. And I also pretty sure that people who did that, they are not aware about other options. So that's not done not because they believe they are less important, that was done because they...
I think it's the way you do physics. You can make one assumption and check it, or you can make 10 assumptions. And then
that's what I like to say. That's what I like to say is that this interpretation is model dependent.
Well, I can tell
in
you
this,
what.
In this way, everything is model dependent.
The CP-violating theories that these people consider, they are well-behaved theories. By theory criteria, right? They satisfy the immersibility and so on and so forth. They kind of look natural, they have new physics at the TV. If you introduce Lorentz invariance, there is hardly any theory for that.
Sure.
Right? I mean, you can.
But my point is that even a lot of measurements which are interpreted as model independent constraints, they are usually not model independent.
They are model independent within the frame of modern physics.
Extension of standard model is not a part of modern physics.
Yeah.
It's a natural extension of it. But the same people could, in another experiment, consider Lorentz violation of Lorentz symmetry. So no, if we try to go beyond the standard model, we always consider possible new physics. And that means that once we introduce a model, we could set a constraint. But if you have no model, we usually sometimes have hidden assumptions, which are not clearly understood.
Moreover, right? PDG quotes the limit on the electric dipole moment of the electron, which is derived from the limit on the Chaldean EDM. You cannot translate one into another without additional assumptions, right?
That quantum mechanics is right. Yes.
That's correct. No, but you can have a CP violating electron nuclear interaction and so on. So you always constrain only some sort of linear combination.
This is simple part. So it's have to constrain a linear non-linear combination.
Right.
But when the Lorentz violation.
No.
Okay, let's go fast.
Non-linear combination. It's just time-saving method.
So the next question of interpretation is related to variation of constants. So in principle, even wording is not very well consistent if we speak about common language. But that's not a problem of language or semantics, because when we speak about constants, we assume that there are equations which contain the constants. After that, we believe that in certain way, we can keep equations and allow constants to vary. So that when we speak about variation of constants, we have in mind some practical approach, which is not quite consistent. So if we like to consider kind of change of constants, usually we should change theory.
I tend to think about
okay.
it as a model of the
scale. Okay. Okay. So just two examples. One is if we like to do something with Lorentz invariance, to have, let's say, speed of light depending of time and coordinate. Okay, sorry, it's mainly for people who do not only particle physics, so they distinguish between t and x, and x is 3D coordinate. So, and what we know is that in this case, it's not enough to introduce speed of light depending on time and space. We need to introduce two functions, and some equations will include their gradients. So we cannot just say that let's keep free Maxwell equations as they are and say that some parameters there are varying. And the second example is that, for instance, let's assume kind toy model where we have space-time with the Planck constant somehow changing with time. Okay, if it's changing with time, not with space, that means that we still have isotropy. Angular momentum should not change. But we arrive to some problem with interpretation of quantum mechanics because we can have electron states with spin directed, let's say, up somehow. We know that it's one half of Planck constant, one half is a number which could not change, and Planck constant is changing. And actually, I don't know how easily to create a theory which would be kind of H variation without this problem. That means that some simple equations should be modified very much. So we could not, in a consistent way, just keep all known equations and say, let's say, H is a function of T. It's more than that.
H because it's dimensional.
Oh, how to measure variation of dimensional quantities? Okay, we can discuss it.
No, it's a different story. In fact, subconsciously, everybody keeps in mind that there is some better scalar field of unknown origin that changes. There are many models with scalar field,
sure.
But it's always kind of a scalar field.
So they're well formulated, there is a Lagrangian that you can derive.
No, let's separate. You can come from model. In this case, you have well spelled model, but in this case, your results are checking of the model. Or you like to go from the opposite side and say that you have a constraint on alpha variation. For instance, you don't care about models. And people with their models should try to check what is alpha variation. So when we deal with experiments, we like to go from this side as far as we can in a model-independent way. And in some moments say, OK, let's come to us with models. But I don't think that experimentalist too much wants to check any particular model. Because it means that once you have a different model, you should reevaluate experimental data. They want to do a single prediction, like electric dipole moment is below something. And after that, you come with a model and check. So that's why it's important to be able to phenomenologically understand whether what things we can do and what we cannot do. And that's about it. So what I try to understand, explain in a sense, is that without model, it's hard to do. In some situations, we come to contradiction. So here, we like to vary H in some equations, and we see that quantum mechanics should be different. So we can introduce some field somewhere and reach some other results, but we cannot just say, let's keep all equations, and one in the end and say that H is changing. That's not possible. And when somebody introduces the field in a certain way, it produces gradients, it produces some variations, but another model will produce different gradients.
Consciously, maybe it's not pronounced clearly. Everybody keeps in mind that there is some field of unknown origin. At maybe
sure.
distance depends on the universe.
Why field? Maybe
or
field.
Maybe size of the universe.
Maybe field.
Maybe dark energy, whatever. But sure. everybody keeps in mind subconsciously, but it's a slowly varying field. So
but it may be
on
field.
The size
they
of
may
the
aren't because they may aren't in different places in a different way. That's important. So from point of view of phenomenology, you don't have a single natural model. So that's why that's important. So experimentalists would prefer not to keep in mind model, but be able to do few steps from experiment and to present data without asking any questions what you theoretician have in mind.
But
that's not possible. That's what I try to understand.
The present state of a theory, you cannot do better. If you can, just please tell us.
Nika, I don't care about theory, I care about experiment.
So you,
I care how far you can go from
experiment. You give a philosophical talk, yeah?
No, I speak about
the real world, there is nothing better.
I don't speak about theory, I speak about experiment. Okay. How far you can go from experiment, you'd be trying not to introduce any really new features. Global
experiment, you don't need a model. I mean, if you do variation of alpha, you don't need a model.
It depends on experiment. So in some experiments, you can have no model, and some you should have model. So and the next point, again, we speak about phenomenology. We don't try to introduce model, and we just try to look from another side. When we have final equations, and try to introduce their sound variations. So where it should be. So quantum mechanics appeared because of interference. So we like to have some picture which allows us interference. So that means that in terms of quantum field theory, quantum mechanics, we should try to pass integral introduce variations into there, not in the final equation of motion, for instance, but only in the Lagrangian. For quantum field theory, it's natural. That would be just the field. But we have no choice. That's important. And so, okay, so we introduce parameters which looks like field, but from a phenomenological point of view, we could have as many parameters as we like. So when we, if we start to build a quantum theory of distribution of light in air, if we don't know any theory, we could introduce one function, two functions, perhaps more functions. So we could introduce functions in many places we like. It's not necessary they will be consistent with some specific model. And we should express everything in terms of vacuum variable, initial variable, and we can have functions like that. So we know that in real media, we need two functions. Maybe not scalar functions, but maybe tensors. So, but even if we speak about Lagrangians, we are not free from gradient terms, because if we like to return to original terminology like T, we don't know whether we should have this kind of gradient, this kind of gradient, or this kind of gradient. In principle, if we try to generalize theory and introduce parameters, sometimes already Lagrangian could have derivatives. And when we go from Lagrangian to equation of motions, we got more derivative. So that means that we always have some gradient terms. So it's important feature of a broad class models where we like variation of constants. And if we have gradient terms, we can try to detect them as in a differential way, like we, for instance, do Michelson-Morley kind of experiment, or we can try to detect just, for instance, some integrated gradient terms inside equation of motions. And this way, in principle, we can measure variation of dimensional constants. In a sense, Michelson-Morley experiment was trying to check whether the speed of light as a certain dimensional constant is the same in one direction and in the other. It was dimensional constant, and it was a trial to check it. No, the difference. The difference.
Ratio.
No.
In fact, they measure ratio.
The difference.
We will speak about it more. So, and if to speak about model independent observation of variation of constants, et cetera, so in principle, there are three kinds of measurements. So we can do kind of fast measurement with a long separation. That's typical for spectroscopy. We can do monitoring, continuous monitoring, like it's in gravity, or we can do differential measurement like Michelson-Morley experiment. So if we do fast measurements, we can neglect gradients. And fast means not that we, for instance, do measurement for 1 hour today and for 1 hour in a year. The time of the measurement, if we try to be sensitive to gradients, is time of a single measurement when photon integrates with an atom. It's rather not interaction time. It's rather in interrogation time because we have certain coherence. But still short time. After that, we should average the results, but not the amplitude. And for results, we don't care about gradients. And so that means that we average over results, and gradients are important only during very short time. And since separation is great, That means that the separation is related to this, while the gradient effects are related to that. Separation is great, we can neglect them. That's why when we do spectroscopy, it doesn't matter in astrophysics or in laboratory, we came to a situation when we are not sensitive to gradient terms. And if we can neglect all gradient terms, that means that in a sense we accept equations which we have, but just sense that constants are changing adiabatically. And in this case, we can do something model independent, but that's not only experiments or observations which are done in this field. So, for instance, this is monitoring when people study big G, and in this case, the time when of study is the same as time of measurement. Actually, that's not so important whether measurement is done continuously, because in a sense, it's something similar to Ramsey's scheme of measurement. So if you do something coherent, you can do measurement, let's say, one few seconds separated by a year. But if you look not for it's an average distance of moon to Earth, but to their position, you don't know about rotations anything, so it's a coherent measurement. And in this case, it's the result is the same as the result of long observation, because you integrate gradient terms. And that means that when you try to do other measurements where you see kind of phase in classical sense, or long-term measurements, you cannot neglect gradients, and you cannot derive anything model independent from study of gravity, for instance, variation of big G. And one example about whether you can neglect gradients, even if they are very small or not, if you study variation in gravity. For instance, you have a system like Earth and Moon, and mass of Moon is slowly changing. So if you accept very final equations, we know that the period of rotation or average radius should not depend on the mass. And we could expect that if we look to the radius, we could not detect where the mass of Moon is changing. But the answer is that's not correct, because when we have the motion of the Moon, momentum is conserved in each moment, and that means that if in one moment you a little bit reduce mass, you should change velocity. And if you change velocity, that means that you should rewrite all equations and the radius is equal to this value. This is longitude momentum, which is conserved, and this is mass of the Moon. Usually you can cancel it, because in normal situation, velocity is also conserved, and this is mass independent. But if you start with a certain momentum and studies the evolution with changing moon mass, you see something. And you can this way see variation of, again, of dimensional value. If you write equations, that means that you should write one more term in the Newton equation, which is a gradient term. But you somehow coherently accumulate the effect over a long period, and this effect is not negligible. And for as a result, we see variation of this parameter, which where you can rewrite in terms of fundamental constant with simple assumption. If you believe, for instance, that number of particles is not changed, and all effects came from variation of masses, an electron mass appears here because you do observation against, let's say, atomic clocks. And so you can conclude about something about dimensional constant just because you are sensitive to gradients. Oh, it's another story. So first, what we also know is that the mass cannot change in conventional physics. And we, and just a second. And that means that we have two choices. First, to use a completely new physics, maybe where we should reconsider some laws. But completely new physics means a model, but model from somewhere outside. And next, we could say, okay, let's try to modify old physics in some way, saying that this some effect, for instance, mass is varying because it pick up a certain amount of dark matter, dust, because of evaporation, radiation, whatever. It could be something not detectable, new in sense that dark matter is not a matter, but we can say that dark matter is governed by the same laws. So in principle, it's half new physics. But in this case, once we introduce a mechanism, how we change the mass, we immediately ask questions, where is this mechanism also produce transfer of momentum, of orbital momentum, angular momentum, et cetera, et cetera. So if we introduce new physics, everything could break. It could, we can break conservation law or whatever. If we introduce even kind of model of old physics, in this case, mechanism could vary not only the mass. So that means that in a consistent way, it's not so easy to vary mass, but not to vary everything else. So even in this case, we have a problem. One problem is gradient terms, and the other problem is that if we try to accommodate something, some feature which is foreign for conventional physics, we may need to accommodate some more features which break conservation law, etc. So it's not so easy to interpret that in a model independent way. You should write a model, and eventually you will constrain just the model. One model you could constrain stronger, the other weaker, and you can say that this is such a combination of parameters which could change the mass and momentum in such a way that it will be no observable effect in the channel you see, for instance, for average value of R. You cannot do model independent prediction. And so, yeah, and we can try to do something what is directly coupled to gradients, studying some violating transition, etc., or do kind of Michelson-Morley experiment. But Michelson-Morley experiment is actually also model dependent. I just remind what originally was sense of Michelson-Morley experiment. It was not a test of relativity. No, it was not a constraint on relativity. It was just two different theories with very clear predictions and what was necessary to distinguish between them. So in a sense, it was even worse than a model. Just to say which theory is wrong, because the predictions were contradicting. You couldn't say that one theory is correct with an uncertainty, and the other theory should be just wrong. It's an easy choice. In this case, you can do experiment to have ideas how to check it very easily. But if you like to check special relativity, it's not so easy. And because of that, I first like to discuss renormalization and the Planck scale physics. We believe that most of really fundamental quantities are defined somewhere very high, even higher than this highest floor in this building. And after that, we should go down and somehow to find a way to rephrase what is the alpha, et cetera, et cetera. And it's believed that in principle, we have a problem to observe everything from Planck scale physics, because in a sense, we don't have fundamental theory. Quantum electrodynamics, I would not say that it's really fundamental theory. It's a kind of fundamental constraint, which says that if we do very few measurements, after that, we could predict a lot. But we need measurements. Without measurements, we can predict nothing. So we need alpha, we need electron mass, etc. That's constraint. And all Planck physics is included in the origin of this constraint at values like alpha. If we would try to calculate that ab initio, okay, we need Planck theory, and we need clear prescriptions, Planck scale theory, and we need clear prescriptions how to go to our energies. That would be theory. And so the quantities are defined somewhere outside of our knowledge, but we need only the numbers which we measure. So, but there are a few situations when we can see something from Planck scale physics, and basically that is a situation when we have there certain dynamics or variation or violation of symmetries. If we have there some problems, we can look for the consequences in our world. For instance, we can write that renormalization of the charge is something like that, where it's some number, and it depends on the radius of universe. And if somebody suggests a theory, radius compactification, not the big radius, but a small radius. So I think half of audience knows very well what is compactification. And for people who are more close to reality, I will just remind that it's believed that we have worked with more dimensions, but more than three space dimensions, perhaps more time dimensions. And we have so-called compactification. So in some directions, we just have a circle. And that means that and the radius is very small. And when we quantize in quantum mechanics the levels in a very narrow deep, we see that they are very far separated. That means that if the radius is small, this is a certain excited state, but it needs so huge energy that we would never see it. So we live in ground state, in a sense, for that. And that is the radius of compactification. And it may be like Planck distance or Now it's very popular to speak that it's much shorter, and it's popular because in this case it could be seen in accelerator, and they could say that nearly every measurement constrains the radius of compactification and says that it should be smaller and smaller because accelerators could not see the Planck scale now. And so if we believe that we have something like that and alpha naught is a real constant, in this case, if radius is have a kind of breeze, some changes, we should immediately see that in our scale because alpha will change. If radius is not changing, we see nothing. Because we measure alpha, we don't know what is alpha naught. We cannot use this equation. But if we know that this change is time dependent, okay, that's something what we can measure. So this is one way how we can say something about the Planck scale. We can say whether it's varying or not.
Sure. Yeah, so it's
all in the same framework. Sure, but I just speak about
R of T, the scale of field.
Okay, sure, but I just you can say that all quantities are here.
There's no. Yeah, there are no directions. All I'm saying. So.
Okay. Okay.
Of course, you have the same naturalness problem. Why is
that? No, I just mentioned that because, for instance,
scale should change now, right?
No, I just remember that first I spoke with some person who believes that the radius of compactification could have variations very fast, and we should see some average way. So it's necessary to remember that if we have something wrong with radius of compactification, we would see consequences. So Planck scale is organized in such a way that we see nothing if it has no dynamics. But dynamics will show it in our world as well. So
if it's very
dynamics, variation of symmetries, for instance, we should see it somehow. And okay. So now I will go to Michelson-Morley experiment. And if you remember, that's very good that you have such a point. The Michelson-Morley experiment is about rotation of a certain macroscopic body, at least classical experiment. So we compare the length of some solid state, piece of solid state with a light, a check time light need for this path. And it looks like when we consider the length, if we have not very heavy elements, and it's a good approximation that it determined by Schrodinger equation, so it's some number of Bohr radii. And the question is whether Bohr radius is any relation to relativistic physics or not. From first glance, we can say no, that's non-relativistic physics. We have Coulomb force, etc. But what is important is that answer is not so clear. For instance, let's assume that there is a big theory in the Planck scale where we can calculate alpha, saying that alpha is pi to minus 4. So in a sense, that means that we can predict strength of Coulomb potential. If we can do that, we should write in theory where alpha is not varying as a first approximation, something like that. If we believe that electric charge has sense by itself, we write something like that. And that means that if we like to violate somehow relativistic physics, that instead of C, it should be something else, something more complicated. Let's have in mind C depending on directions as a very rough approximation. That would mean that in the theory where alpha is calculable somehow, Coulomb law would not be isotropic anymore. It will be depending on the directions. So that means that the very interpretation of Michelson-Morley experiment, once we do it present day with a kind of solid stick of solid state, depends on our assumptions of the quantum world. If you believe that Coulomb law remains and E does not depend on any directions, etc., so we violate something with relativity, but Coulomb force is still isotropic, in this case rotating this body, we will not change its length. Oh, we just check when we rotate, we should see some move on some time of that, some passes, and we can do interferometer, which have directions after that we rotate, et cetera, et cetera. So if we have simultaneous interferometer with two directions, if we rotate, and in this case, the time of propagation would change, and we should see signal. So we don't rotate a single stick. It's a simplification. But still, we compare something. And the signal came from the time light need to go through some.
Well, you measure the number of wavelengths of light.
Oh, in a sense,
the
yes.
Ratio of the number of wavelengths.
No, not wavelength. Oh, in a sense, yes. But
ratio.
We measure time. We measure time. So this is mirror. This is mirror. We measure time light need to go from this mirror to this mirror and compare from this mirror to this mirror. After that, we rotate the picture.
The interferometer is the number of fringes. Number of fringes is
we rather compare time because we have time light need to go from one mirror to the other. And when we have a bit note or whatever, we see the fringes. So fringes which we see are rather related to the time, not to the length. I think so. So we check the time of propagation. But perhaps optical guys could correct me. But again, the basic question is whether length kept the same or not during this rotation.
I'm telling you, you can't measure length on its own.
It's again, length is something different from light. So length of a stick has no relation to the light. And the question is whether it has or not. It's a separate question how experiment is organized. It's organized on assumption that when you rotate, you don't change setup. And when the space property are changed, and you try to detect change of space property because you believe that your setup isn't changed. And that's a classical Michelson learning experiment. Doesn't matter what exactly you measure. You believe that your setup isn't changed. But if you have in mind something like that, that some approximate picture is that, after that somehow violated. That means that once you violate Lorentz interference, once you do something with C, you change the Coulomb law. And once you change Coulomb law, you expand that it's time. Okay. So in this case, again, we could, I just, to finish this case, what we suggested about the Planck scale is crucial for interpretation of this experiment because it's a question whether we change setup or not. Next. There are a number of ways to violate symmetry, but I like to say about some other thing. So additional to real violation of symmetry, we have an observational problem. Because we cannot look for real violation of any symmetry, and we can look for consequences. And that's very important because consequences are based on various assumptions. And if you have in mind quantum mechanics, we remember that in classical mechanics, we can expect that conservation of momentum means that all three components are conserved. In quantum mechanics, when we try to check them, we arrive to contradiction. But nothing happens with symmetry, just its realization is different. If we believe that in quantum scale, quantum gravity scale, something happens with possibility to measure coordinates. That means that we believe that the realization of some symmetries in principle could be more complicated. That means that we can observe certain violations just because we do, in a sense, wrong experiments. Like in classical physics, we try to check symmetries, disturbing the results. And perhaps the last part of my talk is related to another problem of most of experiments. It's a problem that if we try to violate a symmetry from particle physics, the most natural is introduce some external fields. But the problem is that most of these fields look very similar to conventional fields, but they are somehow selective. For instance, one field which we can introduce is that if we ask any experimental person about violation of CPT, he would say that he first expects that the charge is not the same of electron and positron, the mass is not the same, etc. Okay, if mass is not the same, we can write something like that. The easiest what we can do is we can say actually that it's better to write such an equation. So electron and positron have a different charge, and that means that to distinguish between mass of electron and positron, it's natural to say that they are just in a constant potential. But we know that's not observable. indeed, since this potential is not a vector potential, etc., maybe it could be some relativistic corrections to that. But in principle, such an equation in a simple way could not be observable at all. But if we have this value U is not the same, for instance, for electron and muon, the difference would be observable. So we can see that beta dq of muon and anti-muon is different because they have these effective potentials are different. So that means selectivity. If potential for electron and muon by chance is the same, there's no experiments with electron and muon to detect this value. So we need to have at least two particles where this U value is different. Yeah. Sure. But you know, So this is what I mean selectivity. For instance, in atomic physics, usually that is related to coefficient A in Castellani parameterization. So, yeah. And the point of selectivity is that we can write that if you have true field, we have something like that, and have relation between B and A, and this A and B values, they are the same for all particles. Selectivity means that we can have some field coupled to the spin, but not to electric charge, or you can have different field for electron and muon. And because of that, it could be a number of different effects. Because first of all, when you do many precision experiments, you try to shield from external fields. And the result of experiment on non-trivial selective fields would depend on how you shield. Because you can shield in such a way that electron spin inside would feel no field, and that means that you will subtract this value from any fields you have. Or you can say that you kill the if you or you can say that you use some currents to compensate the field. In this case, the field will survive, but this field will be canceled. So when you, because of that, what you actually can measure, you can actually measure differences between terms, because you never could do experiment sensitive to only vacuum term. Because of shielding, you always do subtraction. You produce real electromagnetic fields which compensate some of these funny fields. And as an example of this, these conventional fields, we can consider imaginary experiment when somebody is trying to compare acceleration of free fall of electron and positron. What does it mean? What we expect from CPT? We expect that accelerations are the same. But this experiment could not work because we always have residual electric fields. So what we should do? We should do kind of shielding, kind of Faraday cave. Okay, in this case, we kill all electric fields, we are happy. No, how shielding is organized? If there is no electric field, but there is a gravitational field. Still, shielding says that electron positron is far not the same. Electron is carrier in the shielding material. So that means the shielding can organize in such a way that the carrier particles would not move. Because shielding equivalent when we have just all the space filled by metal, since the charge is on the surface. And that means it doesn't matter for what reason, if electron has feel a force acting on it, it would move. And only after these charges delete all the fields, electrons would stop. So that means that if we do such an environment, when charges are moved, we actually would create a situation when acceleration of free fall of electron would be just zero, and of positron would be double g. I think that was discovered by Schiff with this great example, that we double one acceleration and cancel the other. So that means that we try to do a simple experiment with no assumption, just checking what is gravity for electron and positron, and we see that actually acceleration of their free fall is different. And if we check with proton and hydrogen, we will find that hydrogen have the same acceleration as acceleration of free fall, and proton has very funny correction, which is more common for atomic physics, correction with the mass ratio of electron and proton, because the field should add something, but it should add something which is related to weight of positronium and not to weight of proton. So it has a very small addition. So we see that fields are interfered in experiments, and the shielding is a great problem to have a proper interpretation experiment in the end. It's a question that you have parameterization, like something from Kostelecki, but you can never measure the vacuum terms because you introduce real fields, electromagnetic fields, which compensate part of effects. Yeah. Okay, so I think I will rather finish with that. So the message to experimentalists is that they should be, it's not a huge problem, but it's necessary to consider what they really measure. So what corrections are introduced by shielding, by models, by suggestions. Because very often what they claim they measure is not true. So very often they measure something else. Still important, but different quantity. Okay.
So I think everybody agrees that everything is model dependent. Do you have any other questions?
What is model dependent on the interpretations of deep brain?
Everything depends how brain works properly. Maybe we see some computer simulation. So any specific questions, if you have one? Okay, so we'll go to next speaker, please. We can have 2 minutes break if you want, while it's adjusted. Just 2 minutes if you need.